Hello, my name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters, the official podcast of the museum, where we discuss objects in the collection and how they have meaning for people. Today my guest is my colleague, Matt Pohl, Curator of Indigenous Heritage and the Repatriation Program of the Maclay Collections of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. And today Matt has chosen a remarkable object from the Maclay Collections that tells us about the long history of the Sydney area. Welcome, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Craig. Thanks so much for inviting me on the program.
Now, I'm really looking forward to this episode. Could you begin by telling us what your role at the Chow Chak Wing Museum actually entails?
I work as the curator of the Indigenous Heritage Collections, as well as sort of being the university's repatriation project officer. It's a little bit of both most days. So each day, at the moment, we're working on the new museum project. But the Indigenous Heritage Collections are just such a wonderful, it's been a steep learning curve, you know, working with it for more than a decade now. But every day there's always something new that you sort of connect to these collections and just transform them and see them in such different ways.
Could you just give our listeners a very brief idea of the breadth of the collections? Because that's something that always astonishes me, just how wide from various parts of Australia that we've ended up with material.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, it's three generations of the Maclay family that put together the core of the collection, the Maclay Bequest, and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artifacts in that. There's around 400 of them, but they're from that, you know, contact zone period. This is when all these towns are being formed in different parts of the, you know, then the colony of Australia in the 19th century. And then on top of that, though, you have the University of Sydney Anthropology Department collections, which were principally founded by the Rockefeller Foundation, funding medical research and archaeology, geology, anthropology sort of research. The fact the university here had a really great relationship there. But that's where the bulk of the collection sort of comes from the 1920s to the 60s, and, you know, objects being collected by students, by teachers, by professionals in the field. It's a real snapshot of collecting, especially up until the 1960s when, you know, ethics and a lot of other things sort of changed. So, yeah, you're always working in this interesting time period.
It's interesting you raise that, because the next question I was going to ask is that obviously, you know, obviously the nature of collecting, but in many ways, more importantly, the nature of community involvement and contact with collecting has changed so radically since the bulk of our collection. You've mentioned earlier you've been with the museum for around about a decade now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how some of those changes have taken place more generally, but also in terms of your own work with community consultation and actually involving people with or connecting people with the objects?
You know, it's just constantly transforming, you know. A lot of people have, you know, understandings of these objects that they bring to the museum themselves, you know, and you have to remember for so many people out there in the community who are disadvantaged, you know, in their access to education, you know, so much of what we think of as Aboriginal history was sort of hidden from Aboriginal people themselves, you know, through scientific lenses and, you know, just even high literature written about them or anything like that. It's a real constant process, just breaking down barriers that I have as well, you know, working with these collections, because you think all the time that you sort of know where these things, what context they sit in. But, you know, the more you engage with community and the more that you actually build in that community perspective on these objects, it really upends all those sort of things that you think of yourself.
That's a really interesting observation. I mean, associated with that is your involvement with the university's repatriation program. I wonder if you could let our listeners know a little bit about what that involves and how the processes unfold in terms of community consultation and arrangements for repatriation of cultural material or human remains in some cases.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things that when it happens, and that's the right time for it to happen. It's a lot of conversations, a lot of dialogue, a lot of setting up networks, really. You know, it's communities want to know why these things ended up in the first place. Yep. You know, once you break down that sort of barrier, you sort of move on to the other conversations. But people just have a range of perspectives that they bring to the idea of why, especially human remains, ended up in museums.
Yes.
And there's a real shift in the way that people feel a lot more confident these days to assert their what they think these collections should be, you know, what should happen to them.
Yeah.
I think it's just my job to set up the conversation more so than anything else. Sometimes communities ask that things don't be repatriated now because it's not the right time.
Yeah.
You know, it's not up for the museums to force things to happen as well.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
It's
going to
be a two-way street.
Yeah. Several that I've been really fortunate to work on, they were in the process for years before they actually happened. But then when they actually happen, it just happens overnight and everything falls into place. And, you know, I've seen some magical things, you know, communities coming together for the first time in a decade, people, you know, just getting over stuff, putting grudges away. I mean, that's when you see, a really marginalized community exercising their power like this to, you know, recognize their own mortuary practices in, you know, in the 21st century. I think it's you know, gives a real sense of how the work that we at museums doing actually has real world impacts in local communities. And that's like the most special thing, I think, for what I've been involved in to see.
That's extraordinary. It also shows the power of objects, though, too, doesn't it? That they have such, not just symbolic, but spiritual and connectedness, and that meaning that you can, you know, suddenly appreciate not just an object as a beautiful work of art or a beautiful creation of human history, but something which has an ongoing living connection as well, too.
You know, it's magical. Sometimes we're all standing around a room full of us and an object. None of us are even looking at it. You know, it's the experience of what we're actually bringing together that is the object, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
It's like,
I mean, it's interesting that I'm sure many of our listeners will be aware, but there's very, very heated and ongoing discussions amongst the museum community more broadly in the GLAM sector, the galleries, libraries, and archives and museums, about decolonizing collections.
For sure.
And I think that, ours is obviously only a very small part of a much bigger conversation, but in many ways the work that you've been doing is part of that process of actually democratizing collections as much as anything and sharing knowledge. But would you like to make any comments about that concept of decolonizing a museum collection such as the Maclay Collection?
Well, that's what I've really learned of why you need to carefully contextualize things. I mean, we have a colonial collection, which is the Maclay Bequest. But you can't really call the anthropology department collections colonial because they were founded by the Rockefeller Foundation. So, you know, you have these different sort of contexts in when collections are sort of assembled. To think that, all objects that are in museums are sort of captured under this colonial enterprise
really
robs a lot of the Aboriginal people who wanted to put things in museums of their agency.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a very cautious process. And, like, literally, you take it one object at a time. The most ordinary-looking object can have the most powerful story behind it. It's not even about what the object sort of represents in itself. It's sometimes the connections that have come together to make this object end up in a museum that is just far more a powerful story than, you know, what we're trying to do as a curator interpreting that object, for example.
Yes. Also, of course, that individual connections with communities that, you know, someone like myself who works in European archaeology, there's that mental concept of ancient Greece was here and ancient Britain was there and ancient Germany was there, whereas I suspect that for a lot of Australians, the idea of Aboriginal Australia is this sort of homogeneous nature, which, of course, is completely incorrect. So it's about changing so many mindsets too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I love that concept, you know, the past is a foreign country.
Yeah.
It's always a foreign country.
It is.
Depending on what you're living in now.
Yes. All right, I guess we should really get on to the object that we were aiming to talk about today. So could you talk a little bit about the item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection that you've chosen to speak about today?
This hand axe from Penrith Lakes, Castlereagh, Western Sydney. I mean, I wanted to choose it because it sort of represents the sort of complexity of my work here as well. I mean, I came to, before I worked here at the museum, I'd worked at Bimali Aboriginal Arts Cooperative. I had a very different sort of focus. So, you know, stone tools to me were incredibly sort of impenetrable and obscure. I couldn't sort of work out sort of what they meant. So I was really fortunate to spend those years doing some research and working on that exhibition, The Written in Stone, that came together. And there was one stone that always sort of stuck out to me, its story. Very early in the piece, before we even started on the exhibition, some community members from Western Sydney had contacted me about this item. It had a lot of sort of media attention in the 80s.
Yes.
It was like, you know, contested sort of dates and things like that, and the Sun Herald headlines, you know, Stone Age man found in Western Sydney. And so it was just pulling apart all the tangents and all the layers from this one ordinary object, you know, made me realise just how much more museums build context into objects, I guess.
Over
several times of just working with this one object, it's just always sort of, you know, changed what I thought about collections and about museums especially.
Okay, well, we'll dig into that a little bit deeper, and I want to talk a bit about concepts of deep time with you later on as well too, but could I ask you now to actually describe the axe to our listeners?
It's a beautiful, soft pink rhyolite. In terms of stone tools, you know, there's that, you know, everyone's sort of got that sort of brown geological rock sort of thing like that. But this also has that sort of, it's got this glow to it. It's circular, and it just has along one of the circular edges three or four big chips chunked out of it. Percussion marks, I think they call them. That's the contentious part. That's the beautiful part of the object too. It just sort of, it's just this subtle little edge. You know, one of the things from that exhibition is 99% of people are asking you, why is that a tool and not just a rock? So, you know, it's one of those ones where it's very oblique, the evidence, but it's also there, you know, and from there, that's where you start to explore further.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lovely demonstration, too, of the skill of the flint maker, of the axe maker, to be able to actually work the stone in such a way that it's a usable tool, and yet also doesn't look like it's been worked that heavily at the same time, too, doesn't it?
It is, and it sort of has that. If you hold it in your hand, it's just got that sort of, that weight, the feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes they sort of speak to you. I've spoken to a lot of community members who pick up tools and things like that.
That natural fit,
Yeah, sometimes it's, you know, that's a part of the test as well, especially for Aboriginal archaeologists, I find.
Well, I guess my next question is perhaps a little bit redundant to some degree, but what was the axe used for?
God, in Sydney region, I guess, you know, it's ngawi making, manufacture, stripping large sheets of bark from trees. This one doesn't have a lot of evidence of that, but, you know, the amazing thing that I've come across with some of that other research was the amount of plant residue that's on a lot of Aboriginal stone tools.
Yes.
You know, that's a really interesting story in the sense that, you know, they're not out hunting mammals and things like that constantly. What are these sort of agricultural practices? You know, these deeper, sustainable food technologies that, you know, I don't think we really understand that a lot, and it's stone tools that offer the evidence of that.
That's true. And indeed, much of the scientific analysis of that is still so relatively young as a field of endeavour. But, I mean, of course, the University of Sydney is actually one of the leading research institutes in terms of trying to analyse that material. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, some of these objects within the collection can make that contribution to that archaeological and anthropological understanding as well, too.
It is.
So how old is the axe?
Well, the estimated ages are around 20,000 years, give or take a little bit. That was the contentious part, though. There was like talk of like contaminated groundwater, all different things. It was part of the Penrith Lakes big developments in the 1980s.
Yes.
So they went deep, but also it was a pretty strictly geologically measured, controlled dig as well, which is where they were able to capture a lot of this evidence, which has persisted so long.
So the dating is largely stratigraphic in terms of,
So that's the sort of the interesting part of the story, which is that mystery of, well, maybe, or maybe not. You know, it's always there. There's no clear-cut answers in any of the stuff I find.
Yeah. I mean, I guess as a tool, I mean, an axe is a lovely metaphorical example of the concept of humans using tools. I mean, can you give us your take in terms of how something as simple yet as complex at the same time as an axe gives us some sort of indication about human activity over the millennia?
I just think it comes down to sustainability, you know, using your local resources and, you know, the local landscape to sustainably live in that landscape. I mean, there's a huge lesson for all of us today from that. And, you know, I think what I like about them is they're not overly complex in the sense that it's necessity. You can see in a lot of this sort of tools sort of thing. It's like, you know, there's no time wasted.
You know,
there's a lot of time that goes into the manufacture. You can see that. But, yeah, it's not wasted in that sort of sense. And just that practical, utilitarian sort of functional thing, these everyday things. You know, when so many people try and in the 20th century as well, explored the Aboriginal past, they just didn't capture that everydayness, everyday ordinariness of life for Aboriginal people, I think. And yeah. that's what's missing from a lot of the scientific representations of the Aboriginal past anyway.
Yes, yes. And also, of course, the they were relying just upon what had survived in the ground. And, of course, so much of day-to-day life was organic material, which hasn't survived. But that sort of, well, in some cases deliberate, but certainly that willfulness in terms of, well, we're just focusing on the Stone Age man, as the headline said too, which, of course, has been the big revolution in archaeology in recent decades, of thinking far more about the bigger complexity issues and getting the rest of Australia to think about Aboriginal and Indigenous culture as being far more complex than has traditionally been presented.
Definitely. That's the whole goal with representing it in the new museum, that's for sure, to be able to build in a much more relevant backstory, especially to contemporary community members.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chowchak Wing Museum. My guest this episode is Matt Pohl, Curator of Indigenous Heritage. Matt, can you tell me how the axe actually came to be in the University of Sydney's collections?
Well, that's the really interesting backstory, really, which also was the really intriguing part for me. When I was first looking at this collection, I realised it was donated by a man, Father Eugene Stockton, and I thought, well, that's a bit strange. This is like Catholic priest donating a massive stone tool collection, 3,500 objects. But the more I explored that story, the more fascinating it became. Eugene Stockton was also a lecturer in geology here at the university, I believe. I had a real amazing opportunity to meet him on a couple of occasions. And, he was a really lovely guy. To me, just that understanding of his balance of Western spirituality, but also actually when you look at it, from some perspectives, when he was starting in the 50s, 60s, there was a lot of unethical practices in terms of acquiring material and the way that material was sort of, worked with and separated from community supervision. But in another way, you could tell that he had put so much time, thinking deeply, connecting the connections between all the sites. He did around 60, archaeological digs just in the Blue Mountains. And I guess the other thing with that is I was sort of locked in that thing of, archaeology being out there in remote Australia sort of stuff, like Mungo. But, this is Sydney. There is tons and tons and tons of stone tool evidence of Sydney's Aboriginal past in Sydney. Sitting in boxes in, consultants' garages and museum storerooms and all these other sort of things.
Private people's houses without them realising the value.
When I did that show, I was getting phone calls once a week from people asking me, can I take this object? And we legally can't anymore as a museum.
Yes.
But, that's actually another huge issue that's come from a lot of this orphan collections of stone tools in museums all across the country. We need a national framework just in terms of what to do with them. I mean, the best thing to do with them is to leave them in the country. That's the sites that preserved them for thousands of years anyway.
Yes.
We don't need them in museums all amassed in the one room. That's impractical. It's never going to work. And to break down those barriers that a lot of community have too, because there's a lot of fear out there, rightly so, that what is, if you don't know what this thing is.
Yes.
But also, a lot of stone tools can just be wastage and they can be quite banal, ordinary type objects too. It's the more conversations you have with community and break down those barriers, the easier it will be to actually manage these things.
And the more people can begin to obviously there are certain tools where it's incredibly difficult, and it does take community members who've had experience of working with stone, and it will take archaeological scholars who've done flint making courses to understand. But in terms of the general community's understanding of what was a work stone as opposed to just being a stone as well too, which is something that I've found that often in conversations that people often don't understand the nature of how these tools have been worked. So part of a broader education program in terms of actually understanding at least some of the nuances of the really sophisticated way that stone was chosen and selected and worked for various tools.
Oh, you've seen it. You said like every now and then there's like one that just really stands out. You can sort of see they've sort of hit it the right way. And there's a craftsmanship that goes in them too that has sort of been lost. I've met a couple of Aboriginal community members who are sort of revitalising. Thankfully, to these museum collections, they've got reference material to sort of
to work with.
To check that they're what they've been told from their oral histories is what also exists in the record as well. and, you know, to experiment, to, you know, nothing is set like that.
Do you know why Eugene Stockton was so fascinated and actually, you know, began doing these excavations and so on? Because it's interesting. He's working, or in the early phases, he's working at the same time that you know, universities such as the one we're sitting in were quite deliberately avoiding Australian Aboriginal archaeology and had very, very racist overtones in terms of the way that they were thinking that archaeology should only be about the Middle East and the classical Mediterranean world. So in many ways, it's a unique story of how he was going and doing this.
I'd love to break down those sort of things because they're not helpful for archaeologists or for the community as well. No. Well, when we did that exhibition, we did like 7 different assemblages from different parts of the country, and one of them was Western Sydney Blue Mountains, which was about 70, 80 stone tools from around Springwood and places. And that was the time that Father Eugene Stockton came to visit the exhibition. I was really stoked, and he was looking at all the objects that we'd put on display because we had about, you know, more than 1,000 from the Blue Mountains. And he was like, "Why did you pick this one?" And I said, "Oh, just a beautiful, you know," because there was a pretty random selection. We put a lot of work into it, but, you know, when you're bringing 600 stone tool objects together in a very short amount of time.
Which had never been displayed before as well, too, which is the other thing, isn't it?
It was a little bit of randomness in the selection there, maybe. But he pointed to one and he said, "That's the first stone tool I ever collected." And I was like, "What?" Huh? You know, he was like 12-year-old boy in Springwood and he found this tool. And he told me the story about catching the train in the 1950s down to the Australian Museum and asking at the front desk and being introduced to Frederick McCarthy of all people.
Yes.
You know, Frederick McCarthy spending the day really giving him, inspiring him on archaeology and stone tools and things like that. And just that random, haphazard choice, but to see, for that he got the chance to see it like that, it was just remarkable. It was like the tools, you know, arranging us.
Yes.
But, yeah, when you have really special moments like that, you sort of see that, you know, especially for the non-Indigenous community, when they want to engage, you know, make that effort to engage with Aboriginal culture.
Incredible rewards.
Yeah, you see really special moments.
We should just mention that, of course, Fred McCarthy, for our listeners who don't know him, was one of the pioneering anthropologists at the Australian Museum. And
yeah.
One of the first white scientists to actually investigate the age of human activity in Australia and to actually collect and attempt to understand, within the framework of the time he was working, to understand material culture.
He was popularising stuff in National Geographic, you know, working on expeditions for them in Australia, delivering lectures all across the US, I only found out recently, giving film tours, you know.
Yeah,
that representation of Aboriginal culture, especially during the assimilation period overseas, that's part of that sort of stuff that we're sort of working with too, in the sense of unpacking, you know, other people authoring, you know, the Aboriginal past. And, you know, there's valuable stuff in there, but it's also good to separate it and show people how things work.
Yeah. I mean, that nicely segues into the next question I was going to ask, which was about the concept of deep time, which has become a very big concept in archaeology in recent years as well, but something that I know that you're personally interested in. But here we've got a tool which is 20,000 years old, presumably, and yet has remarkable stories from deep antiquity, but also these remarkable stories from the last couple of decades as well, too.
I know. When you look at the time frame from where it's located, other evidence shows that the coastline of Sydney was probably 10 to 15 kilometres east of what it is now. So we're actually talking about real Western Sydney.
Yes. Like Bondi used to be the Western suburbs.
Exactly. Bondi would have been like, you know. So I always find that, just to be able to see, I love some of the computer graphic stuff you can see where they really strip back, you know, landscapes, you know, and you actually see that, you know, the evidence of the Aboriginal past isn't even on the land that we're walking on now, because the land, and, you know, Aboriginal people have witnessed these transformations of the landscape well.
And so many of those transformations have actually survived in oral traditions that have always been there, but Western science is only now beginning to understand or to ask questions and to actually comprehend that they're recording actual historical events.
Yeah, for me it's just the way, you know, you just take for granted that, you know, the way the landscape that it looks like it does. But, you know, in what are quite short spaces of time, actually, it's just completely different. And when you actually get a glimpse of that, it helps you actually see all other parts of the landscape completely differently, too.
Yeah.
Because there is so much evidence of the Aboriginal past in Sydney, you know, if you want to look for it there.
That's true.
I mean, the other thing is the rock engravings, you know, using rock is an art form in Sydney, you know, the largest outdoor rock engraving galleries on the whole east coast of Australia here in Sydney.
Yeah.
You know, like stone is the sort of the art form of this region, if you want to look at it like that way.
It's and a it Sydney story, isn't it?
Yes, like, you know, all the sandstone dug up from Pyrmont, for example, to build the quad here. You know, it's funny just the way we reconfigure the landscape like that, but stone tools is what helps people do it.
And
I think this one would be great. I think there's some new publications coming out soon. Just the way that this one will sort of reshape the story of Western Sydney a little bit, because it needs to be told better.
You are right. It's a really exciting opportunity to actually rethink the history of the city that we live in, but to rethink the Australian historical narrative as well, too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God, Joe.
Yeah. Going back to the axe again, and I should mention to our listeners that you can actually view images of it in our collection search, which you can access via the web link for the podcast. But what meaning does the axe have for you personally? How do you find you respond to it each time you see it?
Jeez. I was actually born in Sydney too. So, you know, for me, it just sort of reinforces this story of not labouring the point of the colonial sort of thing, but Sydney does have a deep history of, the land that we all walk across every day has this deep history, you know, and we have echoes of it in the names of streets and suburbs and things like that. But also, you know, we just don't sort of know how to ethically engage with it or represent it, you know, on the, you know, feel really proud of it, I think is something that we'd like to, you know, that hopefully these sort of conversations can do.
Yeah.
You know, it's the 250th anniversary this year of Cook's Landing in Kurnell, Kame Bay. Hopefully those sort of demarcations at times where you can sort of say, well, and then the conversation changed. You know, we didn't sort of labour the point about, you know, things that are unchangeable. Because, you know, Sydney does have just a, you know, a fascinating story.
It really does.
And, you know, I just don't understand how we don't get it together to tell that better.
I guess part of it is reframing the narrative, which an exhibition such as, we'll talk about your forthcoming exhibition in the Chow Chak Wing Museum in a moment, but perhaps that's one of the ways that we can help reframe that conversation is to actually use the objects, to use the material culture that has those connections back through time.
We're representing so many other parts of the country that, you know, have to do justice to Sydney being in Sydney.
I've got to say, I've always been fascinated by your career because you have worked with, and still do work with contemporary artists, and then, you know, this concept of contemporary cultural expressions, and yet here we are talking about an object that's 20,000 years old, and how it has an impact upon you personally. How do you find you marry the two together? Can you marry the two together, or is it all part of one story?
Yeah, I like the quandary. The conundrum. That's the fun part, really. Well, I find that's what museums, you know, people expect that in museums, but also to be able to flip that a little bit to sort of show that this is how the contemporary interpretive layer of this object, you know, and there's so many, you know, I think there's so much scholarship out there about that, about, you know, not treating Aboriginal culture as a relic of the past, you know, because it's the ways that we think about it that sort of limit what we can sort of do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more we sort of find empowering language to talk about, you know, the Aboriginal past with Aboriginal, you know, Aboriginal people leading the conversation, it will be, it's just maybe now's the time to sort of, you know, really reconfigure that better.
Yeah.
At least the new museum is a space where we can have much more detailed and longer conversations than we were able to do before.
And chance to explore that continuity as well, that you know, this is all one narrative, this is all one story, this is the story of people.
That's right. Actually, Western Sydney is the largest diaspora of Aboriginal people in the country too. So, you know, represent, you know, these very, you know, contemporary communities, sometimes with older objects, is where you just get the more interesting stories, I think, and better conversations.
Now, the question I'm asking everyone on this podcast, which is throwing some of my guests, but if you could choose one word as to how this object has meaning for you or what it signifies for you, what would be that word?
deep.
Deep.
It's deep.
I like that.
Yeah, that's the first one I could think of.
That's great. Thank you, Matt. So I guess to wrap it all up, we might just talk very quickly about your forthcoming exhibition, Ambassadors.
Yeah.
When the Chowchak Wing Museum opens to the public at the end of 2020, can you explain to our listeners how you are exhibiting some of the fantastic material culture from various parts of Australia?
Yeah, it was a really interesting process to come to this stage, but the Ambassadors exhibition is around 100 different objects from 25 different language regions, and that's spaced out across 8 sort of different display cases throughout the museum,
yeah,
which are sort of positioned in places where we can sort of, you know, have dialogue and engage with the other exhibitions that are on display in proximity, yeah, to these cases.
I've got to say, I'm very excited about that idea personally. Sense that instead of it being one gallery, this is again part of the any visitor to the museum's story is that they're always getting that Australian perspective as well, which is great.
You know, placing the Australian story in the global context, which is especially what Aboriginal Australia is, you know, is so good at doing. Mm. You know, it. And, you know, for me, to be able to position these exhibitions for entirely new audiences, you know, especially Southeast Asian communities, and, you know, exploring that story deeper, allowing people, you know, from Indonesia and that to bring their stories of this,
yes,
northern coastline. You,
yes,
know,
yeah,
there's just so many more communities to connect with in Sydney too, in the sense that, you know, it's a collection that we've consulted with First Nations communities right around the country. But one of the key parts of feedback they gave us was with, you know, who do we speak to next?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, you're a bit of a sort of conduit like that when you sort of put these shows together, because, yeah, for me, the most important part of this exhibition is actually sort of putting it out there and letting other people use the exhibition for, yeah, their own, whether they're artists or historians or, you know, just curious people. It's the same thing.
A chance for them to share their stories and their responses to the material as well, too,
that's,
isn't it?
You know, keep bringing it out of the past, you know, yeah, breaking down that sort of idea of what it used to mean, and sort of just, you know, talking about what we would like it to mean, you know, what it could mean for the better.
So will the acts we've been discussing today be on display in the opening iteration,
right,
of,
yeah,
Ambassadors?
Sorry. So, well, there's basically like an index case in the foyer space, and this actually comprises one of the ambassadors that welcomes you to the museum from the Sydney community, yeah, in that sort of sense, through the consultations that we've done. So there'll be, yeah, sort of like a wayfinding point, I guess, which is sort of in the entrance, yeah, space, which sort of introduces you to the Ambassadors exhibition,
yeah,
and sort of gives you a sort of a point to follow as you're going through different spaces. When you see, you know, incredible shields from Biggin shields from Innisfail, for example, next to a Grecian statue. Why? But, you, yeah, know, but there is a story there.
There is a story there. Yeah. I love it. From deep time, this axe is going to be one of the contemporary,
yeah,
pathways of exploring the collection, isn't it?
I was pretty excited when it sort of got a, you know, into the final selection for those ones, because it is a very beautiful object and represents Sydney in a really beautiful way too.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Our guest this episode of Object Matters has been Matt Pohl, the curator of the Indigenous Heritage at the Chowchak Wing Museum. Thank you for joining us. Very much appreciate the chat.
Oh, it's really great. Thank you for inviting me on again. I loved it.
Thank you. I hope you can join us for the next episode. Thank you. You've been listening to Object Matters. The Object Matters podcast is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chowchak Wing Museum pays our respect to the traditional owners of these lands. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.